This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this week for a look at the political races and stories in Kentucky, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman. Later in the show, we'll get an update on the trial of Ray Tensing for the shooting death of Sam DeBose with WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Michael and Scott, good afternoon. Good to see
both
of you.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Let's start by telling you about the U.S. Senate race that's going on between Rand Paul and his challenger, Lexington Mayor Jim Gray. Now, we've got less than 2 weeks to go until Election Day. So what's going on with the race at this point?
Well, it's kind of interesting. You would think that race on the surface should be really high profile. You have a former presidential candidate, libertarian hero, and Rand Paul running for his first time for reelection. And then you have Jim Gray, a Democrat, popular mayor of Lexington. I think he might be the first openly gay Senate candidate.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. That's correct.
Yeah. But it's really received very little attention. It's mainly because no one gives Jim Gray any chance of winning. He's not given up, Jim Gray. He's still traveling around the state. But it being a very strongly Republican state, and with incumbent senators on average winning 80 to 90% of the time, people have pretty much written the state off as Rand Paul safe and let's move on to other things. But Jim Gray is still at it. He's coming to Northern Kentucky next week. He was in Northern Kentucky over the weekend talking about the Brent Spence Bridge. So he's giving it the college try.
So has there been any kind of backlash against Rand Paul because he pushed at the GOP caucus during primary season? Have we seen any negative impact?
No, people have already forgotten about that, I think. There was some grumbling about that when he was still running for president, although he dropped out before that.
Yeah.
So yeah.
He ended up out of the race before it even happened. So
and people thought, well, that's pretty embarrassing, but people's political memories sometimes are short. And again, he's Republican and it's Kentucky. And so he's pretty safe. I haven't heard anyone mention that.
And obviously Kentucky's going to go overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And I'm sure there are some Donald Trump supporters who might still hold a grudge against Rand Paul because Rand had some pretty awful things to say about Donald Trump back in the days of the GOP primary when we were all watching those debates. I mean, even called him like an orange-faced something or other.
Mm-hmm. He didn't go to the RNC, and he's said, I support the candidate, but that's all he'll say.
That's right. And Mitch McConnell was in town today. He was in Covington at the Kenton County Detention Center.
Is he still staying really quiet about Donald Trump?
Exactly. One of the reporters present for this press conference about the expansion of the heroin task force coming into the Northern Kentucky areas from Ohio, he said, we're not here today to talk about the political race. And the reporter reiterated that he was asking in the context of the heroin situation, and McConnell said, we're not here today to talk about the heroin race or the political race.
And if Mitch McConnell doesn't want to talk about something, like I've asked him questions before, he doesn't want to answer it, rather than saying no or I got to go, he just turns around and walks away. Like, he doesn't even pretend.
He also has a very disciplined staff around him. There's a guy that's always there that says, we're out of time.
Yes.
And that's it. There is not another word to be spoken.
But so far, not a peep about Donald Trump, even when he was in town.
Not
recently.
At all.
In terms of Northern Kentucky, does Northern Kentucky now lean more GOP or more Democratic?
Definitely Republican.
Definitely
and
Republican.
It's been trending that way, and it looks like that's only intensified in recent years. I mean, all three counties will easily go for Donald Trump and Rand Paul.
There are enclaves like Covington, Newport. There are a lot of Democrats concentrated there, but then it's overwhelmingly Republican everywhere else.
And you know, I got to be honest. I spend a lot of time in the River Cities, like Scott does. So I'm mostly in like the urban part of Northern Kentucky, and even in those places like Bromley and parts of Bellevue, I probably have seen more Donald Trump signs than I've seen Hillary Clinton signs. So I think the Republican stronghold on Northern Kentucky is only getting stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I think Rand Paul made a comment recently where he said that Kentucky is becoming more conservative. Mm-hmm. Which he says plays in his favor.
That's right.
Yes.
When Jim Gray was here, you said he talked about the Brent Spence Bridge.
Yes.
How much is infrastructure playing out as an issue in this campaign between these two?
It's I mean, that was what he wanted to focus on in Northern Kentucky, because when people think of Northern Kentucky outside of this region, they think, well, everyone cares about the Brent Spence Bridge. And actually, last time I was on here, they actually might be right, because that was we had like 20-some calls on it just by mentioning the name. So it's a big factor in Northern Kentucky. But I mean, outside Northern Kentucky, and that's a statewide race, you know, it's and I don't know if people are going to be voting. I mean, I don't think that will have any impact on the Senate race, because it's more just Republican-Democrat. Which ideology do you...
Yeah, that's a more of a polarized year. And it's interesting because I noticed when Jim Gray was here last time, it reminded me, when he talked about the Brent Spence Bridge, it reminded me of the 2014 race between Senator McConnell and Secretary of State Alison Lundergan Grimes, who was challenging him at the time, because the bridge became a very important issue towards the end, because McConnell came to town with this very secret topic press conference. All we knew was it was related to the bridge. And he gave this presser out at the Chamber of Commerce, and ended up being kind of a bust on what his proposal was to pay for it. It was like repealing prevailing wage. But I know the Grimes camp at that time was all caught up. Well, they issued their own plan minutes before McConnell issued his about what their plan would be for the bridge. And now here we are a couple weeks out from another election, and the senatorial candidates are yet again coming up with these plans about the bridge. It's going to happen again in four
years.
Which
Scott predicts won't be, we won't have a resolution for what, Scott, four decades, did you say?
It could be, yeah, if ever. I mean, no one's stepping forward. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I hadn't thought about that in like 2 years, because no one's mentioned it since.
I know, right. It's kind of been a dead issue outside of just some local flare-ups. On occasion, you'll have maybe a social media post or somebody pushing a talking point. But outside of that, I think people have bridge fatigue as a topic, and that's dangerous, because it is, you know, for those of us in the news media and those of us in the business world, it is still a very important topic, but it's just so difficult to talk about, because where are we with it? You know, what's the starting point? What is the status of the project? It's very difficult to say.
But those plans that they trucked out, yet I have not heard a mention of it from McConnell or anything since he got reelected. That's...
In fact, Rand Paul's plan is probably closer to Grimes' plan.
Yeah.
When he's talking about bringing money back in from overseas, she had a lot of those talking points in her proposal as a Democrat in 2014.
That's right. Rand Paul has proposed the tax credits or lowering the tax to bring money back. But that's always it's nebulous on how much money that stuff actually brings in, and it's not
right.
It's not guaranteed money.
And the process, how long does a process to get some type of reform like that? And that's years in the making to get this very polarized Congress to do anything, especially to create a program like that that would siphon any money back to this area for that bridge.
Michael, what do you see as being some of the other key issues in this race, though?
In the Senate race? It's very hard to say, because I think that The general voter is, I mean, we've all been bombarded with this Hillary Trump thing. It's just dominated the entire narrative. So we're kind of polarized on these issues. So is it people upset about health care or the health care reform? Kentucky has played a very significant role in the national conversation about health care reform. But in the context of the race between Rand Paul and Jim Gray, I don't see that as being that significant. We know where they both stand on this issue. But in Kentucky, we're about to see a significant change with the way Obamacare is implemented as Connect goes away.
It's going away next week, right?
Yeah. I mean, those of us who use it, and I purchased as a small business owner, I purchased through the healthcare exchange in Kentucky. So I got my letters, you know, telling me how to purchase healthcare moving forward. It's not going to be through the state.
Yeah, they're mainly worried that there's going to be a lot of confusion. People might not successfully enroll just because it's going to be different than what people are used to. And Connect got people praised it when Governor Beshear unveiled it as very user friendly. They had connectors that assisted people in enrolling. That's going away, so it remains to be seen how much of a confusion and how much of a problem it's going
to
be.
Do we happen to know how many people this is going to affect?
Well, there were 440,000 people enrolled in Medicaid through it, and about, I think it's like 83,000 through their private insurance through Connect since it started.
And think about that. I think that more than anything, more than the politics of the issue, this is a case study in branding, right? So if you come to Kentucky and you say the word Obamacare, you'd have 440,000 people probably shuddering in their shoes, mm-hmm. screaming that, I mean, this is a very unpopular president in the state, but you rebrand it and you call it Connect. And suddenly they praise it. And now you have a Republican administration that's dismantling it, as he promised to do and as he was elected to do. It's going to be interesting to see if it has any effect at all in the Senate race. I don't think it will. I think that people are mostly voting along their national ideologies this year.
Mm-hmm. But you say you've gotten the notification that that it's going away because you use Connect. You've used Connect.
That's right. Yeah, I'll purchase through the federal
exchange. Through healthcare.gov.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the tricky part here is making that transition as smooth as
possible.
That's
exactly right. Yeah.
So in the presidential race itself, has the Libertarian or the Green Party candidate had any kind of an impact in Kentucky, or have they even tried?
I haven't heard anything. Have you?
Well, you know, there are pockets of Libertarians, and they're very vocal and passionate. So they've got an office open on Pike Street in Covington. So the Libertarian Party does have an office open. Gary Johnson, their presidential nominee, is to be in Cincinnati tomorrow, I believe, tomorrow afternoon at Great American Ballpark. But I don't see him having much of an impact. I think he kind of faltered there toward the end. He was surging in the summer. I saw some pretty significant poll numbers, but I think that fell off pretty quick.
Trump won pretty handily in the Republican primary, and I don't see that changing.
Yeah.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. So, Scott, as far as the race between Rand Paul and Jim Gray, has there been any recent polling on that?
I don't think anyone's really expended much on polling because they don't see it
worthwhile.
There was a poll that I think, and I can't remember who did it, because there was one poll and it was showed Rand Paul up by double percentage points.
But then there was another poll that had it like within four, and I'm you know the source
that's the one
is
Jim Gray's looking at.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that one was popping up on
those with a grain of salt, though. It all depends on who's doing them.
Jim Gray has been posting he's had a sponsored post on social media that I've seen 100 times that says they've got polling that shows that they're within striking distance. So they must have some internal data that may show the race close, but I don't think the public perceives it
that'd
way.
That'd be one of the biggest electoral upsets probably in history.
Yeah,
if that happened,
right.
I would think. Yeah.
When we'll continue our conversation, you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this week as we review the news from Kentucky, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer, River City's reporter Scott Wortman. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mayor's race in Covington. This has been an interesting one, Michael.
Let's talk about something else, Mark. Gosh. Yeah, it's intense. It's hot. And Scott, you moderated their last debate
last night.
And you could tell this was like their third of the fall. With each passing forum or event, that they were getting more and more tired of each other.
Yeah.
Did you sense that last night?
I've been sensing that for quite some time, though. They want to say a lot more too, and are struggling to bite their tongues.
That's right.
But
so
are they pretty much each of them staying on message? That from each debate to debate, they don't seem to stray too far off of where they stand.
I think Joe Meyer has proven to be a very disciplined debater. Of course, he's been at this a very long time. I mean, he was first elected to the state house in like the early 1980s. So he's a very skilled politician. So he knows how to prep for these things. Sherry Caron, who's the incumbent mayor and has been the mayor for the past 4 years, has never been particularly good in these types of environments. But this is the strongest I've ever seen her perform. So she has really gotten it together here in the fall, hammering her own messages. So you in the spring during the primary, I felt like her heart wasn't in the reelection bid, but you can tell that this time she's taking it to them and they're fighting pretty hard.
So what are their messages? I mean, what are the issues that each of them are hammering home here,
Michael? Well, if I'm just summing up in what like the quick bumper sticker looks like, Joe Meyer says change, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you do
so
when
he
you're
says he's the change candidate.
He's the change candidate. Sherry Caron says stay the course.
She's the status quo candidate, according to him.
So getting specific, it's Sherry Caron saying, look around. When has Covington ever had a better reputation regionally than it has right now? When has Covington ever had the amount of development that's happening downtown than what it has right now? This is an era of strong prosperity in Covington. Let's stay the course. We're gonna move this development southward. We're gonna keep this positive energy. That's one of her buzzwords, positive energy. We're gonna keep this going. Joe, on the other hand, would say, well, sure, there's development happening, but we need a skilled leader to handle this more responsibly, and we need to pay more attention to a couple other parts of the city that maybe have not been receiving the attention that downtown has.
Yeah, there's two different realities being portrayed in Covington. One where the sun is shining and businesses and residents are flourishing, and then Joe saying there has been some progress, but there's been a lot of missed opportunities. The city's hard to work with. He touts the home builders are endorsing Joe Meyer because they don't like a lot of the regulations that Covington has, historic overlays, things like that, that a lot of home builders have complained about. They're two completely different views of what's going on in the city.
No, of course. So if he's the change candidate, if that's how he's portraying himself, he's going to be the one saying, we have problems that we need to fix and I'm the one to do it.
Yeah, it's a message of doom and gloom in a lot of respects of the characterization of Covington through his messaging is fearful in a lot of ways. It's capitalizing on some of the message from the fire department's union, who has hit the city administration hard on the change in staffing in the South Covington firehouse, which has eliminated its ambulance service for budgetary concerns. Mm-hmm. The current administration says that's not affected public safety at all. The union and the Meyer campaign would suggest otherwise.
Yeah, the Joe Meyer blamed that on three buildings burning down in South Covington, but Sherry and a few of the city administration said they were vacant buildings, and that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it.
That's
so yeah,
right.
they're blaming things on, you know, like one says the city's burning, the other doesn't. So
what Scott said is something that I also said just after the second forum that they had that I attended, and I left thinking, what? It's so hard to write about. But I just kind of did a monologue into a microphone. I was like, I just got to talk about this. And I did a little podcast and I said that these are two different Covingtons that these candidates are talking about. And the interesting part of that is that there is a constituency for each of those messages, because when I'm out and about in certain parts of the city, there are people who are really excited about the transformation that Covington has undergone. I mean, it's a very significant change, but there are other people who don't feel it at all, who don't even believe it's happening.
Well, it's interesting, Michael, because this sounds like it mirrors the national presidential campaign.
In a lot of ways, it does.
That you have one candidate saying, we have so many problems, I'm the guy who's going to fix them. The other one's saying, hey, it's not that bad. It's pretty good. Let's stay the course.
That's right.
I don't know if you might have a perspective on this too, but for as long as I've been covering Covington, you know, off and on my beat over the last 10 years, like under the Denny Bowman administration, there were two factions too, also portraying, one Covington where the sun is shining and another where it's like, you know, it's a cesspool. And
you know, it's interesting that you raised that point, because that's sort of the subtext in this race, is that there's a new guard in Covington, and then there's an old guard in Covington, and the old guard has been out of power. And does Joe represent the old guard? He's backed by Denny Bowman. He's backed by another former mayor. He's backed by the unions and a lot of the people who used to run the show. Sherry Caron she came in as an outsider. She pulled off an upset when she was elected to the city commission in 2006, and has been an outsider against these folks ever since. So the question is, does Sherry Caron actually represent the change? Is what we've seen in Covington under Sherry Caron's administration the change? And is there another constituency that wants to see it change back?
And it seems like Sherry, for as long as she's been on commission, she's always gotten a lot of votes, but her support doesn't ever seem as vocal or as visible. Like, you can never tell who
she is. A very quiet base,
yeah.
But they're out there. And I think that there was a primary race in Covington. You have to, only two people can run in the fall, and it's a nonpartisan race. So if there's more than two,
right.
They have a primary.
If I understand right, both these candidates are Democrats, aren't they?
Well, actually, Sherry Caron's a registered Republican,
okay.
Which has become a weird talking point in the race, because,
okay.
But Joe Meyer's a Democrat. And according to Clayton Castle, who reported for the River City News at the debate you moderated, Scott, last night, he quoted Joe as saying things about, the government works for you, you don't work for the, he had a lot of those sort of Republican talking points. And then Sherry Caron, who is known for her, known very superficially as like an environmentalist, is the registered Republican in the race. So, I mean, it's a crazy year.
She says that she identifies, Sherry Caron identifies as a Democrat, but only registered Republican, because most of the races in Northern Kentucky involve just Republicans. And in order to vote in those races, you have to be a registered Republican.
She switched ahead of the Kenton County Judge Executive race last time, and she wanted to support Chris Knockelman, who ultimately won that race. But she hasn't switched back. So,
and it put, talking to some Dems, it put them in a bind because they had to endorse, and it's a nonpartisan race, but they had to endorse Joe Meyer. He's like, well, she leaves us no choice. I mean, she refuses to change back to Democrat.
And she cut the ribbon on the Democratic headquarters that opened next to City Hall. So it's just all very
awkward. It's all very confusing.
I tell you, it's tough down there, man.
At least if you go by party brands, it's very confusing. So I guess the key here in this race is to look at what they're saying, what they're backing, what their stances are. 513-419-7100. Let's talk with Steve in Covington. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I was calling really because the comments you guys made earlier about the impact of libertarians on this race and kind of the up and down of Gary Johnson, I've noticed that I tend to identify as a libertarian myself, and I've noticed that the millennials seem to be gravitating quite a bit toward the ideals of the party, and I'm curious to get your take on what you think the future might hold relative to libertarianism locally or nationally.
Okay, Steve, thank you.
I still think it's – I haven't seen anything different. While there is an appeal towards libertarianism, and people often say there should be more than just two parties, it's still a small percentage and fringe, and I don't see anything that has changed that.
That's right. I mean, the question I always ask somebody who comes at me with the remark that we need a third option, we need a third party, my question is, that believes what? A third party that stands for what? What I find in this crazy year is that there is a lot of distaste for the two main nominees from the Democrat and the Republican Party. Bernie Sanders certainly brought a lot of new people into the process, and these are people who may not want to resort to the traditional voting options. So if ever there was a time for experimenting with libertarianism or another party, this would probably be it, because people are shopping.
Well, and Michael, don't you find too, when people talk about being libertarian, they're oftentimes talking more about the political philosophy itself, as opposed to being a member of that particular party.
That's right. It's hard to nail down when you meet libertarian candidates. Of course, they have a platform that they adopt at a convention like any other party. But when you meet people who say they're more libertarian, in my personal experience, this is just anecdotal, what I find is these are folks who may subscribe to traditional Republican economic policy and then traditional Democratic social policies.
And no one since Ross Perot, there has never been a third-party candidate that got a substantial amount of votes.
Yeah, I think Ross got in the Ross Perot got, what, high teens?
Yeah,
I think.
Near 20%.
Yeah, 19%.
And unless a third party can do something like that, it's not ever going to be seen as legitimate.
I find that most of my libertarian friends are people who would go to a gay wedding but bring a cheap present.
I'm wondering, too, in the Covington's mayor's race, how much the heroin epidemic that's been striking the region, how much is that playing out as an issue between these two candidates?
It's always a question in any of the local races. It's a question in the statewide races.
It's such a big thing.
Yeah, that's right. It is a big thing. But it's like,
but there's
what
no
impact?
Clear answer.
There's not an answer. And again, with Mitch McConnell being here earlier today talking about this issue, he was asked directly how he felt about the lack of conversation about heroin addiction at the national level in this national campaign. He refused to comment on it because he's hesitant to talk about Donald Trump, I suppose. But at the national level, they're not talking about it, even though the heroin epidemic really is gripping the entire country. But Northern Kentucky in particular has emerged as an epicenter for this situation. And whether you're the mayor of Covington or one of the judge executives in one of the counties, you're not going to have any cure for what this is. I mean, we're facing a situation that is a national emergency that, regardless of who the mayor is, it's not going to impact whether your son or your neighbor gets access to heroin.
And I think politically, for a lot of politicians, I mean, they see it as a safe topic. I mean, no one's for heroin use. And so they're eager to talk about it, but they don't know what to do about it.
Now, another issue, the streetcar system. Is that playing any kind of role in this race?
Slightly. It's sort of a novelty question for those of us in the media.
It's fun to talk about.
Well, it gets a lot of speculation, for one thing.
Because that's right.
There's the talk of let's connect up the two systems between – have Northern Kentucky hook up with Cincinnati and have this great big streetcar system going around between the two areas.
That's right. And in disclosure, I'm a member of the Northern Kentucky Streetcar Committee, so I'm out of the closet as a streetcar supporter in Northern Kentucky. But to see the question come it was asked this week to the city commission candidates in Covington, and I was pretty pleased to hear that everyone's at least open to exploring the topic. I think there's only one candidate who seemed to dismiss it. And in the mayor's race, Sherry Caron has been pretty supportive, and I think Joe is open to studies as well. Newport is where it's more intense because they have actually contributed money for one of their city commissioners mm-hmm. to go to Washington, D.C. and start to lobby for opportunities to bring some funds in to conduct a study on the feasibility of bringing the streetcar over.
But that's where the big hurdle lies, because Massey's already said, I don't support allocating money to this. And he's the Representative Thomas Massey. He's the Northern Kentucky's congressman. And with it being a very conservative federal delegation in Kentucky, it's going to be a tough sell to get money back for that in Northern Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, though, Michael, is that Northern Kentucky at one time had a streetcar system, just like Cincinnati did.
I always say we had it right the first time.
Well, they also built a bridge, too.
Yeah, they did. They were able to do that.
513-419-7100. Let's talk with Andrea in Covington. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Andrea from Covington. Recently joined the board of the emergency shelter. And I'm also a big fan of the River City News podcast.
Yay.
Listened to it last week. Michael, when you mentioned during that second mayoral debate, there was I don't even know what you want to call it. There was an instance that was discussed, the expansion of social services and where the candidates stand. Not being able to make last night's debate, was that brought up? And then just sort of want to hear your take on that issue and its coverage in this debate.
Cool. Thanks, Andrea. I'm glad that you listened to the River City News. And Scott would probably be better to talk about last night's forum because he was there. I was doing one in Newport. I have a report up at rcnky.com by my writer, Clayton Castle. He did a great job recapping it. But social services has emerged as a pretty significant topic in the Covington mayoral race because Covington is the center for all of Northern Kentucky's social services. Mm-hmm. If someone is homeless, if someone is addicted to drugs, if someone's going to jail, all of those things are in Covington. And this has emerged as an issue. I think that it's probably fair to say that the Meyer campaign has said that this is a problem.
Yeah.
And did it come up last night?
It did, but there wasn't anything new that was said. I mean, both candidates and pretty much any elected official you talk to in Covington, they see the need for social services, but they want them in other cities as well.
That's right. They need to share it. I mean, like the needle exchange, that's Covington has approved it because that's what Covington does. Covington hosts these things. But one sticking point is the homelessness issue. And Andrea mm-hmm. said that she's a board member of the emergency shelter, which is the only cold shelter in Northern Kentucky for overnight stays. And there is a dispute between Sherry Caron and Joe Meyer on the number of homeless people currently in the city. Sherry says that they've seen a reduction year over year of 47%. Mm-hmm. And Joe says that the numbers provided by the Kentucky Housing Corporation indicate otherwise. So there's even disparity on, what the data shows in terms of homelessness. Previously, Sherry at the previous two races had said that she's stated this multiple times that Covington has seen a reduction in homelessness. And Joe has said, it was more anecdotal that, I've seen homeless people on Scott and I've seen homeless people on Pike Street. It's not getting better. Social services and whether there will be more in the city is definitely a point of contention in the race.
Well, I think the big issue that they're up against is that Covington being an urban city, that's where a majority of the poor and the homeless are. And that's where the services need to be.
So is Newport, right? Yeah. And there's not a shelter in Newport. And I think that before there's a needle exchange, for example, the way that we've set up the needle exchange in Northern Kentucky is Covington passed an ordinance that said mm-hmm. we will host a needle exchange in our city limits as long as one of the other two counties in the region do it as well. Okay, so Kenton County and Covington have both adopted the ordinance, which would allow it, but they're waiting on either Boone or Campbell. Boone shot it down. Campbell County's fiscal court has approved it, but by state law, one of the cities in the county has to approve it. So Newport would seem like the likely choice because of its urban nature, but the St. Elizabeth Hospital is actually located in Fort Thomas. So there's this very quiet dispute happening between these two cities on where that would lead, but that speaks to Covington's resistance to bearing the burden of the region's social services
and needs. As far as I can tell, Newport City Commission has no plans on bringing that up. They're just hoping to just let it stay.
None of the incumbents came to the forum last night where this was a question. And all of the challengers who showed up for the forum that I moderated last night, they were in favor of at least talking about it. But one of the challengers, Ken Recton, suggested that maybe Fort Thomas should be looking at it.
Now, before we move off the political discussion that we're having here, Michael, River City News is having a big political extravaganza. Are you going to tell me about this?
Mark, I think you're overselling it. No, it's going to be awesome.
I saw this on your own website.
I know,
it looked like it was going to be some kind of a big blowout thing.
I hope you come because it's going to be a lot of fun. We tried this in January. It's called RCN Live. And we did this in January. I'm a big Bill Maher fan. I love Real Time with Bill Maher. I don't miss an episode. It's one of the reasons I've subscribed to HBO and Game of Thrones, of course. So next Friday night at the Hotel Covington, November 4th at 8 o'clock, we're doing basically a localized version of the Bill Maher Show. We call it RCN Live. So I'm the host and
Of course.
I cast myself. And Adam Edlin, the former Kentucky auditor, is going to come up and he's going to talk about the effort to rebuild progressive politics in the Commonwealth of Kentucky and the great hill he's climbing up. And I've got a great panel put together to talk about local issues. I got Fernando Figueroa, the new president of Gateway College. I got local journalist Allison Montoya, and I got former Inquirer politics guy and turned PR guru Pat Crowley, who's going to come on and talk. And we'll be drinking, so everyone be nice
Pat
and loose.
Here, yeah.
Exactly. Pat Crowley will throw some back. And so we'll be loose and we'll have some jokes and we're going to have a lot of fun at Northern Kentucky's expense while really going in depth with some important issues on a Friday night.
Yeah. Scott, let's talk about what happened with the city of Florence this week. Settled a lawsuit with two other female police officers. Now, what was this about?
There were two female officers in 2014.
They're both expecting, right?
Yeah. I believe they both had one still pregnant, one had her child. In 2014, the math on that, I suppose they both have their children.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were both pregnant in 2014 and wanted to go on light desk duty. One of the officers had, during a previous pregnancy, the police department let her say, yeah, you can do light duty, no problem. But for whatever reason, there was a change in policy in the city of Florence. And they said, no, we won't allow you to do that. You have to take leave and some of your sick time. And so she filed a complaint with the Department of Justice and worked its way through the—
So this was a discrimination suit that went
discrimination
through the system?
Discrimination suit, okay. Yes. And thanks to, in part, to a Supreme Court decision in 2015, a UPS case that sided with the pregnant employee saying that you have rights and they shouldn't deny you what they would give other employees, the city of Florence decided to settle. They paid out or will be paying out $135,000 to the officers. And the city of Florence has 30 days to rework their policy to allow for pregnant employees to go on light duty, no heavy lifting job description is pending approval of the Department of Justice. But women's rights advocates are saying this is a huge victory and sends a clear signal to employees across the nation that you have to treat pregnant employees just like you would any other employees that are injured or have disability or anything like that.
Now, Michael, River City News this week had a story about a new mixed-use development that would highlight Ludlow's past and present. What is this?
Yeah, it's
a big
deal.
They're thinking about. Yeah, this sounds very interesting.
Well, first of all, Ludlow is hot right now, and it's a cool river city.
And by the way, this place is what? Ludlow Yards is the name?
It's called Ludlow Yards. That's the proposal. So it's important to note that this is not necessarily a development yet because there's not a developer behind it. But Hub and Weber Architects, based in Covington, very creative folks there, they've created a drawing utilizing a lot of the historic infrastructure that's already there, harkening back to some of the railroad yard days of Ludlow's past. What's significant about this is that it runs counter to a lot of the new developments that are emerging on both sides of the river in terms of new housing. When you look at the apartment buildings at the banks, when you look at the new apartment buildings that are going to be popping up soon in downtown Covington, whether they be the ones near Mainstrasse Village or the ones next to where Braxton Brewery is, just west of Madison Avenue, they're different, but they all kind of have similar themes in their design. The Ludlow Yards proposal is an effort to integrate more of the historic design and use into the concept. So right now it's in its infancy. You can read about it at rcnky.com. And you can see the rendering there too. And on Sunday, I'll have a podcast posted with the guy who drew it, Jim Guthrie, the architect, very, very talented, creative guy.
Is he basing this somewhat on Longworth Hall in Cincinnati? Is he
it looks a lot like that, exactly.
That readapted warehouse?
Precisely. So the idea would be that there would be retail components, there would be office use, and there would be residential units. And Ludlow recently hosted Beyond the Curb, which is the urban living tour in northern Kentucky that happens twice a year in the river cities, a different river city produced by the Catalytic Fund, and tons of people came and checked out the urban living options and to see what people are doing, whether it's restoring old mansions or turning abandoned buildings into cool live workspaces. A lot of that's happening in Ludlow now. Ludlow seems to be the place that's attracting hipster families. That's what I'm noticing. So like when you're hitting your mid-30s and you're starting to have some kids, that Ludlow is a little quieter than, say, Mainstrasse.
Place to be.
Yeah. So well,
they got a circus there. They have a
circus-based economy. Yeah. And they have the Circus Mojo and the Second Sight Spirits. They've got a fencing school.
DeVue Park's part of Ludlow, isn't
Jerry Springer does a podcast there every other week.
Yeah, Jerry Springer does his podcast at Folk School Coffee Parlor. The mayor has his own coffee shop. The mayor's opened up a coffee shop, Ken Wynn, Winner's Cup. DeVue Park is Covington, but Ludlow is
sits
just
right on
the other side
of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Is this going to become reality? I mean, is this just all talk, or is this something that's actually going to happen?
Well, you know, it's hard to say with developments like this, because it's not like it was drawn with any price tag. So you draw to fantasy, I suppose. And then maybe somebody who's got some money will come in and check out the feasibility of it. And I know that if something like that were built, that people would live in it. Retail would probably be harder to attract. I don't know that they have that critical mass yet, but...
Yeah. That is a good point, though, because there are drawers full of... renderings and plans that I have at the Enquirer that have like never come to fruition. There's one that was done in the 90s of a monorail going through.
I remember that.
Yeah. So yeah, it's
and somebody once drew a rendering of a new Brent Spence Bridge.
Yeah. Okay. Let's not start on that. So meantime, though, Covington. You also had an article about Covington's looking at what could be its next big project. What's that?
Okay. So this is a really cool building. It's called the Bradford Building, and it's at the corner of 4th and Scott Boulevard. Okay. So if you hang out at, say, Molly Malone's, it's just around the corner from there. And it's been vacant for at least 15, maybe 20 years, mostly vacant. And the Catalytic Fund, who I just referenced, they have acquired the building. It's a situation where they're poised for development, but there's not a developer attached yet, at least not publicly. So this is a situation where the Catalytic Fund has come in, secured this building, and now it's waiting in the wings to be developed. The cool thing about it is that just across 4th Street from it is where the Boon Block is. And if you've read anything or seen anything about the Boon Block, this was a huge old warehouse that was almost entirely abandoned except for a tiny corner that housed Dick's Liquors. There was a liquor store in there. Dick's Liquors was in there. And they transformed it into 9 luxury three-story townhomes. And I think all but one are already sold. And that's over the $350,000 price range. So whatever becomes of the Bradford Building, I think that the signs are pointing that it will be a very positively received development. And it's cool to note that the Bradford Building is named for Bradford Schinkel, the son of Amos Schinkel, who was very instrumental in getting the Roebling Suspension Bridge constructed across. I know you just told me not to talk about bridges, but there is a historic connection to the name Bradford.
Before we go, emails have been in the news a lot. What the heck is going on with these emails between the city of Covington and the firefighters there? That's I think Scott even knows about this.
Scott and I have spent a lot of time together sitting in city meetings at Covington City Hall, and they all, I find, and maybe you'll agree with me, that the longest Covington City Commission meetings always involve a grievance with the fire department.
I would say half of the public meetings in Covington probably involve the union.
Yeah.
In some way or another. I mean, yeah, the union really, and it's not just the Karen administration, it's been that way.
Historic. And you know what's interesting is that the union president, the firefighters union president, said something very telling about a month ago in public at the podium in City Hall. He said, "We're firefighters, we're never going to be happy." I thought that's a damning statement, really, because it just speaks to sort of this perception that the union's always going to be fighting with whichever administration. But the current, to your point, to your question,
they've got an open records request.
They do have an open records request that they've submitted, and they say that it's not been fulfilled. It's a little murky for me to understand.
How many are they asking for exactly?
Well, I don't think
1,600 emails is what the city said it was.
That's right. So,
which is not unusual for I've had requests like that have been fulfilled in a very quick manner of time within a few days. But they said that they've been inundated with dozens of requests from candidates, the unions.
So the city's saying
this. The city's
saying
that. And that they just don't have the staff to go through and make sure they aren't releasing any like Social Security numbers, private information, and they have to go through each email individually. But
and what they're looking for, I don't know.
That's what I was going to ask.
I don't know.
What does the firefighters union have?
They claim there's a dispute over – they got a grant to hire new firefighters, and there's a dispute over what the staffing level should be. And the firefighters are claiming that we want to see communications between the commissioners and the city manager to find out why they're saying they're only going to get 114 firefighters and not 118 firefighters.
So more to come on this one.
Oh, much more to come on this one.
Well, Michael and Scott, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. River City News editor and publisher Michael Monk spanned Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman. Coming up, we'll get an update on the trial of former UC police officer Ray Tensing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The trial of former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing got underway this week with preliminary jury selection. Tensing is charged with murder for the fatal shooting of Sam DeBose during an off-campus traffic stop in July of last year. And joining us with an update, WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Hi, Tana. How are you doing this afternoon?
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. So where do things stand exactly with the trial at this point? They started off doing, they call it preliminary jury selection, right?
Well, that's what I'm calling it because the jury selection, as we sort of typically think about it.
The voir dire where you see the questioning in the courtroom.
Exactly. Yeah. So that all starts on Monday on Halloween. So they threw out a larger net than they would normally do for a trial. So they had some 200, 50 plus people that had to come in and fill out questionnaires that were crafted by attorneys for both sides. So they came in on Tuesday and they were all brought into the courtroom, in groups of about 50 sworn in. And asked if they had any reasons why they could, if they wouldn't be able to be sequestered if need be, if they had to be out of town.
So they're asking for personal reasons why they might not be able to be a juror.
Right. So about 39 of that, say 250 or so, were excused. And then the rest of them went back and filled out these questionnaires. And then all week, attorneys for both sides have been going over these questionnaires and I guess sort of whittling down the list of folks they want to bring into this selection process next that starts on Monday.
How extensive are these questionnaires?
The one for this trial was pretty extensive, in my opinion. It's 25 pages long, 194 questions. I don't know. Yeah, so it must have taken a while to fill out.
Tana, do you know if that's typical of a jury? That seems like a lot to me.
I don't know this. I have to be honest. This is the first trial I've sort of covered this in depth, so I don't know if that is usual.
But suffice it to say, this is a pretty extensive questionnaire.
It is extensive, in my opinion. So a lot of it is basic biographical information, your background, your education level, stuff like that, that I do understand is asked frequently. And then it sort of gets into a little bit more in depth about, your perceptions of law enforcement or your perceptions of groups like Black Lives Matter, that sort of thing.
Have you heard any of the attorneys voice any concern about seating a jury who hasn't already seen the video of the confrontation between Ray Tensing and Sam DuBose, or seen any of the news coverage? Has that played a part?
Well, I think certainly the defense is probably not very happy about a lot of the things that have been said in the media, specifically by the prosecution. However, nobody has sort of expressed. Now, the defense has asked for a change of venue. At one point, they filed a change of venue motion. But the judge certainly seems to think that she's going to be able to seat a jury.
Yeah. And that's also one of the reasons why they had this particularly big jury pool coming.
Correct.
Was that many. So how long is it expected to take to get a panel seated? Does the judge have a time frame in mind, or no, just however long it takes is what
they're
going to go with?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Judge Megan Shanahan, she made a ruling in the case during the week. And what was that about?
So they had some, they're called motions in limine, so some preliminary motions that had been filed about what evidence might be able to be presented at the trial. And so they heard arguments on that on Wednesday, and she ruled that Sam DuBose's medical records, he had been apparently treated in the hospital earlier in 2015, she ruled that those could not be brought into evidence, that they were not relevant to the case. His past criminal record, she said, you know, adhering to, there's plenty of records, state law precedent, that does not come into play here, should not be brought into evidence, would not be relevant, would only serve to maybe taint the jury or prejudice the jury to Mr. DuBose. So she ruled the medical and criminal records out, and also marijuana that was found in his bloodstream after, you know, once after he was deceased. And they did it there. They had a toxicologist from the county that came in and testified that with marijuana, the way the body sort of processes that drug out after death, it's impossible to know when the drug was ingested. So sure, it was found in his system, but it could have been minutes before, it could have been days before, it could have been hours before. There's not a way to scientifically determine it. So she ruled that out. However, marijuana found on his person and in the car that he was driving, she is allowing that into evidence.
Now, so her concern was that the jury would be prejudiced or might be misled by admitting the evidence that she said no to. So why did Tensing's attorney want that particular set of evidence admitted? Does he think it shows something in this case?
Well, it presumably, I mean, what he argued in court would be that presumably all of that might affect why Sam DuBose chose to act the way he did. He knew what he had in his car. This is what he would be arguing. Maybe he knew what was in the car. He knew he has, you know, felony convictions for drug possession. So, you know, he maybe already knows that he might be going back to prison if, you know, if he gets, if this is found out, you know, the car is searched or whatnot. And so maybe that was his motivation for wanting to flee. That's the argument that he presumably would have been making.
You know, one of the questions in this questionnaire, I think, would be how much of this have you been exposed to? How much have you seen? How much have you read? And can you put all that aside and be fair in rendering a decision in this case?
Right,
that's one of the things that they're asking about.
Correct. That is a question that I think that a lot, that both sides would be specifically interested in knowing. You know, is it a juror, someone that's able to still consider both sides?
Now, of course, the body cam video of the shooting is going to be part of the evidence in this case.
As far as we all know.
So how do the prosecution and defense differ in their views on this body cam?
Well, so the prosecutor, Joe Dieter, said to the media on Wednesday that, you know, in his interpretation, the video shows that the car was rolling slowly just prior to the shooting, and it moved 15 inches. Now, the defense says the video clearly shows something else, that it shows that the car, you know, was speeding and moving at a very high rate of speed. It sped away, and that Mr. Tensing's arm got caught in the car. But then also Stu Matthews, the attorney for Ray Tensing, did say, you know, well, some people see what the prosecutor sees. Some people see what we see. Some people can't see anything at all because the video quality is so shaky. So, yeah, many ways to interpret lots is of, what th- is
lots
what
of different
he would
interpretations,
argue.
Which I guess is going to be up to the jury to decide how they interpret it.
Correct.
So once they next week they actually start with the questioning. So that's the next
the voir dire process of the jury, right? And then we would have opening statements. We had said last week in our news review that we thought that would happen the following Monday.
Right.
I'm not certain if that's still the time frame.
Tana, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Why some people enjoy having a good scare thrown into them, while others refuse to even watch a horror movie. On our Halloween Cincinnati edition, we'll discuss the science of fear. We'll also explore the haunted crime scenes of Ohio for those who do enjoy a good fright. And in focus on technology, Dubai plans to lead the world in the use of 3D printed buildings. That's Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.